The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
Thank you, Peter. And in case this is your first of the three that you've been here, you might like to refer to the recordings of the other two talks where I kind of outlined a transformative political manifesto for Christians in the first talk. Sounds grand, doesn't it? And that was in the first talk, based on Romans 12, 1-2. Then last week we talked about peace. And again, I outlined the idea that peace begins in our own personal relationships. And that's outlined again in Romans, these passages from Romans chapter 12 and 13. And today I want to talk about tax. So I didn't want the tax idea to be sort of out on its own, as if I've just chosen to do that. But it is interesting that the Bible does address the issue of tax. My own son has been reading conservative and libertarian political literature, and so we have arguments at the table because he's come to the table and said all taxation is theft. Recently, maybe that's your view. I look forward to hearing from you later. This is what Paul says in Romans chapter 13. Let everyone be subject to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except that which God has established. The authorities that exist have been established by God. Consequently, whoever rebels against that authority is rebelling against what God has instituted, and those who do so will bring judgment on themselves. For rulers hold no terror for those who do right, but for those who do wrong. If you want to be free from fear of the one in authority, then do what is right and you will be commended. For the one in authority is God's servant for your good. But if you do wrong, be afraid, for rulers do not bear the sword for no reason. They are God's servants, agents of wrath, to bring punishment to the wrongdoer. Therefore, it is necessary to submit to the authorities, not only because of possible punishment, but also as a matter of conscience. This is also why you pay taxes. For the authorities are God's servants who give their full time to governing. Give to everyone what you owe them. If you owe taxes, pay taxes. If revenue, then revenue. If respect, then respect. If honour, then honour. So I guess today I want to talk to you about a shocking three-letter word ending in X. Yes, it's tax. As I discovered in doing some research for this particular talk, I discovered that an old classmate of mine from Trinity Grammar School had become a professor in tax law. And we had a lovely conversation on the law, and I didn't realise how wonderful and interesting tax is, but there you go. It's a controversial subject, certainly, and gets people talking. Is it right to seek a tax effect? Is it right to minimise tax? Is there a difference between what is legal and what is ethical when it comes to paying tax? And what if the government is misusing my taxes to do something completely immoral? Like starting an unjust war, or whatever you might judge the government to be doing. Probably every government is doing something immoral somewhere. We'll get to that later, but first, Christians live with Jesus as Lord of all, and together we've become part of his kingdom where things are different. This is a kingdom of love, not of law, of peace, not of war, of transformed nonconformity, as Martin Luther King called it, transformed nonconformity. He was preaching on Romans chapter 12 when he coined that phrase. Christian politics is really about showing in our life together a different way. But we still live in that other kingdom too. Christians inhabit two kingdoms, if you like. We are Christians, but also residents or citizens of Australia, living under the rule of our Queen and the parliaments we elect. Jesus is Lord. But that does not mean we can drive on the right side of the road instead of the left. You can't wind down the window and say to the policeman when he pulls you over, but you see, I follow Jesus as Lord, and that means I don't recognise your right to determine which side of the road I drive on. Now, this is a trivial example, of course, but for many Christians in the first century and today, it's far more serious than that. In the years immediately following the writing of Paul's letter to the Romans, the Emperor Nero blamed the fire of Rome on the Christians and unleashed a persecution, a savage persecution against them. In the years of communism in Eastern Europe, the government acted punitively against Christians, in some cases treating them as if they were mentally ill. My parents used to give me a newsletter about Christians living behind the Iron Curtain, and there was a particular Christian musician in Russia called Valery Baranov, and he was sectioned for being a Christian and treated with medications, which of course brought on mental illness, for his advocacy of Jesus Christ, for his standing for Jesus Christ in those days. Not far from here, if you are a Malay citizen of Malaysia, then you are forbidden by law from changing religions. I go and do some teaching at St. Mary's Cathedral in Kuala Lumpur, and there is an evangelist there who works amongst Malay people, and that is extremely dangerous work in the Kingdom of Malaysia. How should we then live in the realm of Caesar or Morrison? How can we live with two lords? Well, this is where Paul takes us in this famous passage from Romans chapter 13. Paul's readers may have been expecting him to say, "Jesus is Lord, so spit in the eye of Caesar. Plan a revolution for when you can, when you've built up enough numbers. Or at least, put a custard pie in his face," or the first century equivalent. But he says exactly the opposite of that. "Let every person be subject to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God, and these authorities that exist have been instituted by God." The strategy is pretty clear. Governing authorities are for us to submit to. Christians have no exemption here. We are called to respect governing authorities, not to rebel against them or disregard them. Well, how come? Because of the origin of their authority. Not because they are ultimately authoritative, but because they are penultimately authoritative. Their authority derives from God. They may think that their authority comes from the people, or from the constitution, or from the military coup that they engineered, or from being born as heir to the throne. They may be pagan, or Muslim, or atheist. But it is God who actually works through all these means to establish rulers and to topple them. If there is political authority, it is because God has instituted it. Now let me pause here so that what I've said, or at least what Paul has said, can sink in. Remember, he's not naive about what misused political power can do. Remember, this is the guy who worships the crucified Messiah, who is put to death by the Jewish and Roman leaders. He worships a man unjustly crucified by the authorities. But the right of a ruler to rule, he says, comes from God. Now we have to be a bit careful here, because Paul does not think that an emperor or a king or a president has a divine right to rule in an absolute sense, as it was understood in the Middle Ages. Many rulers have thought of themselves as divinely appointed and thus above criticism. This forgets that legitimate political authority involves, as the great Christian philosopher John Locke said, evolves. Political authority evolves from the consent of the governed. God's appointment of human rulers is indirect. He works even through the sometimes questionable processes that we human beings use to find a ruler. Now, you might think that Paul is quite a conservative. He's certainly not a revolutionary. At the same time, what he said here is quietly subversive. It is in fact a radical thought. Human power does not stand by itself. No human ruler is ultimate, except for Jesus Christ our Lord. Every president, king, sultan, nawab, emperor, potentate, chairman, CEO, prime minister, prince, premier, and mayor has a power that derives from somewhere else. The arrogance of human rulers is completely silly, and our fear of them is unwarranted. They have their power from God. Now, the Christian martyrs of the early centuries knew this, and even as they were tried by the authorities, they said again and again that they honoured the emperor and prayed for him to God. But they recognised that there was a higher power than the government they were able to respect, but not worship or fear it. They were able to respect, but not worship or fear those who ruled them. Now, this is as much a message for those who have power and influence as for those who live under it. Human beings are only ever God's deputies, whether they recognize it or not. The effect this has is to humble those who have political power and to liberate those who are subject to it. We can respect political power without fearing it, and we know not to make it an idol. Is it wrong to hope for a change in the person who governs us, or the method by which we are governed? Would it be wrong, for example, to want Australia to become a republic? In principle, at least. I think it's wrong for other reasons, but there you go. Or to vote and even campaign for the opposition? Not at all. Debate and reform are recognised as entirely legitimate means to change and improve government. But why has God set up political authority in human life? Have a look at verse 4. For the one in authority is God's servant for your good. But if you do wrong, be afraid, for rulers do not bear the sword for wrong, God, for no reason. They are God's servants, agents of wrath, to bring punishment on the wrongdoer. God has given the idea of government to human beings for a quite specific purpose, a limited purpose, actually, to punish wrongdoing. Their role is to limit evil and to administer justice. Now, we expect more of our governments than this. We want them to be preservers and transmitters of our national identity. We want them to come up with curriculums for schools and tell us what to think about what is right and wrong in all sorts of areas. We want them to give expression to our dreams and aspirations. We want them to pay for our sports teams to go to the Olympics. We want them to build ideal or close to ideal societies. But for Christians, Paul would say, we pin our hopes not on governments but on Jesus Christ as our Lord. We don't see our dreams being fulfilled by princes and prime ministers. The job they have is to restrain evil the best they can. And they've been commissioned by God, given the sword, to do this. Now, I think this idea should help us as we approach the ballot box in a democratic society, as the good electors of Wentworth will be doing very soon. We don't vote for the government to evangelise the people of Australia. We don't vote for the government to Christianise the people of Australia. What we want as Christians is the government that will best uphold justice and restrain evil. Now, it can do that by a variety of means. This doesn't just mean getting tough on crime, by the way. It may mean redistributing wealth so that we don't have a desperate underclass forced into crime. It may mean introducing incentives to behave well. Now, that's all completely up for grabs, and people will have their different views on that. We don't have in the Bible an endorsement of big government or of small government, of the free market or of the managed economy, of monarchy versus democracy, or vice versa, of a particular form of punishment, or any of the details. This is important, by the way, because we're pretty passionate about our politics, and I'm sure that's true of people in this room, but we should recognise our freedom in Christ to disagree. Nothing makes me crosser than people saying, how could you be a Christian and vote for XYZ? We should try to apply Christian principles to the business of governing the state, but it's a complex thing to do, and it's not the main game for Christians. There will be Christians who have political philosophy, who have a political philosophy you think is appalling. That's fine. But to misquote Kevin Rudd, God is not a wholly owned subsidiary of any party. I think this is important because increasingly, following the pattern of the United States, the Christian vote is being seen as attached to one side of politics and not the other. And it's good to know Australia's history and the history of the Liberal Party and the Labor Party, and to notice, and even the Greens too, believe it or not, to notice the influence of Christian ideas in the origins of all those political philosophies. We don't notice that so much about the Greens in New South Wales, because the Greens in New South Wales are communist. The Greens in Tasmania and the West have Quaker and Mennonite roots, and I understand. And so, a kind of Christian influence on their politics is there. The one political view that I think Christians can't endorse is anarchy. Christians are not anarchists. The Bible is clear that government is a good thing. It takes a pretty bad government for it to be worse than no government. Visiting the former East Germany recently, it was fascinating to talk to people who've been brought up under communism. Their freedoms had been restricted, and there were many injustices inflicted on the population. But it was still the case that order had prevailed of a kind. It was certainly better than the social breakdown that had occurred at the end of the Second World War. Certainly, it was much better for women and children than that anarchy had been. When the US toppled Saddam Hussein, it made a terrible mistake. Saddam was a terrible ruler. He was an evil man and a tyrant. But toppling him left a power vacuum into which a ruinous and untamed malevolence has stepped. Bad order is better than no order. We destroy political order at the peril of the innocent. There's this great scene from the life of Brian when the People's Front of Judea have gathered to plot a revolution against the Romans, and John Cleese says, "What have the Romans ever done for us?" Remember that scene? And someone says, "Well, there's the aqueducts." And someone else says, "Well, it's the roads." And then someone says, "Hey, there's medicine." And someone else says, "Well, there's peace. And you can walk the streets at night." And Cleese says, well, yes, but apart from those things, what have the Romans ever done for us? This makes the point perfectly. Nothing. Yeah, political order is a tremendous blessing from the hand of God. Indeed, the Pax Romana, which in many ways was so anti-God, was used by God for the spread of the Christian gospel across the Mediterranean. It was the Pax Romana that made the mission of Paul a possibility. And so Christians should respect political order. Have a look at verse 7. "Give to everyone what you owe them. If you owe taxes, pay taxes. If revenue, then revenue. If respect, then respect. If honour, then honour." We'll deal with respect before tax. We are to give honour and respect to those in power, the respect due to them as God's commissioned servants to do his bidding. Now, I don't think this means we can't name evil when we see it, or that leaders are above critique, but respect and honour for the ruler supports the good of political authority that benefits not just us, but our neighbours. We respect our rulers not because of something inherent to them, but because they are doing a difficult and God-ordained task on our behalf. We Aussies don't do respect and honour very well. We tear down rather than build up. We see ourselves as blissfully free from the terrible class-bound ways of the old world. But having respect for judges and magistrates, public officials, police and politicians serves our society well. And for those people to be respectable, I have to say. Holding those officials to a higher standard is part of honouring them. It is right that a corrupt politician or accountant receives the stiffest of penalties. In fact, a magistrate told me that they are inclined to really enforce the law when they see a white-collar criminal because of the trust that's invested in them, and trust that's been abused, and that trust that's actually the glue that holds society together. If they're not held accountable for that, then we fall into disorder, or it introduces disorder. They are demeaning the precious gift we have of a well-ordered society. Do you have respect for our public officers, or do you too readily join in the game of tearing down? Cynicism towards politics and politicians is having a negative effect on the notion of political authority itself. Part of our transformed non-conformity will, I think, be to show respect, due respect for political authority, and to pray for those who wield it. But here's the tricky question. What if the political ruler is evil? Do I have to respect and honour Adolf Hitler even as he sends my neighbour Jews to the gas chambers? And this is not, of course, an abstract question for Christians in the Germany of the 1930s, and Dietrich Bonhoeffer himself wrestled with this, as we know. Peter the Apostle said we must obey God rather than men. There's no doubt that when the command of the state contradicts the command of God, we must respectfully disobey the state. But can we overthrow an evil ruler? Bonhoeffer took Romans 13 very seriously, but in the end found himself unable to conclude anything else but that Hitler's regime was such a corrupt and demonic form of government that to act against it was necessary. Notice that Paul does not say do what is lawful so much as do what is good. The call on us is to do what God has declared to be good. That may, in exceptional circumstances, mean doing what is unlawful. If the Lord said that I had to deny Christ, then I would break the law and accept the consequences. And if the ruler has become as monstrous as Hitler, then we've reached the exceptional circumstance in which political order itself was the cause of evil. But I'd still obey the traffic laws in Nazi Germany, even as I plotted to kill Hitler.
On the Autobahn.
Yeah, that's right. But for us, the Hitler dilemma is not so much as an issue as paying our taxes is. Paul says, pay to everyone, give everyone what you owe them. If you owe taxes, taxes, revenue, revenue, honour, honour. Respect, respect, honour, honour. Revenue, by the way, is the word for indirect taxes, so he's got the GST covered. Why do we pay tax? Well, that's in verse 6. We pay tax to government because it's been given to us by God to bear the sword against wickedness. As my former teacher, Professor Oliver O'Donovan, says, taxation is for the support of government. Taxation is for the support of government. So Paul says, pay the tax that is due to the government. Now, I know what you want to ask. How much tax is due? Does that mean to pay as little as I can get away with? Now, I'm not going to address the fine ethical distinction between evasion, avoidance, and minimisation. In fact, my tax professor friend said, those words are so rubbery they mean nothing. But here's a Christian point of view. Pay the tax you owe the government with a willing heart, because good government is a great blessing, because political authority is a massive blessing, a good that God has instituted. As Oliver Wendell Holmes said in 1927, taxes are the price of civilization. We can name the many blessings we enjoy because of tax paying, the aqueducts, medicine, the roads, etc. But also, Christians should be completely above reproach in paying our taxes. Many people have said to me that they have the attitude that it's up to the tax office to make the rules so that whatever is legal is also ethical. This is what I call the Greg Chappell underarm bowling approach to tax. Let's make this clear. I hope the readers understand that I don't need to explain that. Let's make this clear. The ATO website says this: you have the right to arrange your financial affairs to keep your tax to a minimum. This is often referred to as tax planning or tax effective investing. Tax planning is legitimate when you do it with the letter, within the letter and the spirit of the law. However, some arrangements attract our attention to determine whether or not they are lawful. If the Apostle Paul isn't enough for you, listen to the tax officer's view of its own rules. Keep to not just the letter, but the spirit of the law. My tax professor friend said, if it looks like it's a tax dodge, it probably is, according to the tax office. Work hard then. Christians, work hard. Pay the tax we owe and pay it happily. A good rule of thumb might be that if you are involved in an activity whose sole purpose is to minimise tax, then it's problematic, even if it might be, strictly speaking, legal. We Christians don't do strictly speaking. We are, after all, transformed nonconformists. And I know we'll all be saying, yes, but, because the system encourages loopholes, and we love our loopholes. But what the gospel demands of us is a changed heart, where we seek not to do as little as we can, but as much as we can. What does that mean then for you as a taxpayer? The details are up for you to decide, but check your heart and what Paul teaches and what Jesus also teaches. Give to Caesar what belongs to Caesar. But do that because you've given to God the very thing his image is stamped on, your very self. Thank you. I look forward to your questions and comments and insights. I've got a question that I'm going to start with, which I think I've kind of answered, which is, how did God's authority establish Mugabe, Hitler, Stalin, and someone whose name I can't read? What is not to rebel against? And I think the answer is God put all of those rules in place, but sometimes the ruler's rule is a judgment on his people, or the ruler's rule is actually it doesn't mean that God has endorsed that rule. It means that it's part of God's plan in history that he brings about this particular form of rule at the time. So, for instance, some Christians in America have said, well, Trump is God's man. Well, yes, God put Trump in, but it might be that God has put Trump in as a judgment on those who elected him, on the United States. Who knows? It does not endorse it. This was a great debate in the 1930s because some Christians had said, history is turning in this way, and Hitler is God's man in the sense that this is what God is telling us, this is what God is endorsing. And that misunderstands Romans 13, and it misunderstands the nature of how we understand what God is doing in history. What God is doing in history is revealed to us in the declaration that Jesus is Lord, And whatever happens in the meantime refers to that particular truth. That came out, if you ever want to, if you've got time to look later, Bonhoeffer and Karl Barth were involved in a thing called the Bauman Declaration in the 1930s, which was a response to this view of some Christians that Hitler was God's man for Germany in the 1930s. In other words, he was anointed by God and endorsed by God. And it's a great, I think it's a wonderful declaration for our times, because it really skewers that idea that that history is telling us something, that we can read off history what God is doing, whether to the left or to the right. And it tells Christians, look to the Lordship of Christ to understand what's going on in history rather than to the events that swirl around us, which are never finished, of course. Okay, if you are living in a Muslim country, should you obey Sharia law as a Christian? I need to know more about Sharia law, which I understand is mostly religious law and not state law. So I'd need to understand more about how that was practiced in each instance. For instance, in Malaysia, I don't think there's no sense in which non-Muslims have to obey Sharia law. There might be parts of it that I obey, like food laws, because I think food laws are irrelevant for Christians. We can obey them or not obey them as we see fit. It would come down to whether I was actually being asked to worship another god. And if I have to bow down before Allah, that's where you'll find I'm civilly disobedient right at that point. It might be that if it's the law of the land and it just means how we live, then at points I think I can do that, especially if my goal in being there is to declare Christ and to witness to him. So false worship is the kind of key, is the real key here. And also then I would say if you're really asked to do something which is morally wrong, then I think that's according to the Bible, then I think that's a point in which I would be civilly disobedient. If the current exemption for Anglican ministers authorises marriage celebrants for having to conduct same-sex marriage is removed by Parliament, should Anglican ministers obey that law? Yes, in the sense that we may hand in our marriage licences. That is, if we are forced to, if we cannot discriminate, then we should obey the law by not marrying people, because we don't want to go against our consciences. There's an argument, of course, that the state should get out of marriage and shouldn't be part of it, but that's not how we in our Anglo-Saxon tradition have operated in that way. That would be a moment in which we might draw back from doing state marriages and do a private thing called Christian marriage, which would be entirely different, and then people could get married at the registry office and come to us for a church wedding. It would be different and under different arrangements. I guess that's how I would do that. I think that would be that would uphold political authority and recognise and respect it, but it would not be it would be not caving into what I think is the wrong thing to do. If government's role is to punish the wrongdoing, does that mean that government also has a role to promote the good? Can government be a morally neutral arbiter? This is my point on the particular origins of the New South. My point on the New South Wales Greens was spot on. Thank you. I do remember when I was at university, it was the socialist left, people selling the socialist left, the Trotskyites selling the newspapers on the campus, overnight became the Greens. It was the same people, just a different newspaper. I remember it quite clearly. If government's role is to punish the wrongdoings, that means... Well, this is a really interesting question, because what Paul outlines in this passage is actually a negative thing, isn't it? Political authority is given to punish wrongdoing. But he's a little bit more reticent about promoting the good. He doesn't say promote the good so much. And I guess what I want to say is that we must stop believing that governments are there to promote a particular vision of human fulfillment and flourishing. They're not there to do that. In fact, I think they should probably try and get out of that business. And when they do that, it's when they become dangerous and idolatrous. So there's a little bit of a small government idea here, that really the government's business is to make sure that that wrongdoing is stopped. You can scarcely do that, I suppose, however, without promoting some vision of the good. I think this is one of the great problems in the way we approach law-giving, that we often use in public conversation. There's often a libertarian argument about various things. For instance, over euthanasia, the freedom argument will be put forward, as in, you don't have to practice euthanasia, but I want the freedom to, and so government should get out of that. However, it is true that what you allow, you permit. And so, the government has a role there to kind of say, no, this is an evil that we don't want to see prosper in our... not only what you allow do you permit, what you allow you endorse. And so I think the government still has a role there to say, no, we don't endorse that. We can't even permit it, because to permit it would be to endorse that. Perhaps more conversation on that could take place. Paul is neither a conservative nor a revolutionary. Do I have a political label for him? Yeah, he's a Christian. I think that's the best thing to say. He's I really don't want to give him a political label, because I think it would distort what he's trying, the particular thing he's trying to say. And I really think we should follow his lead and not be so easily boxed in. I think the predictable way in which Christians are able to be, we think that Christians will vote one way because we tend to, or our public voice seems to sound like we're endorsing one side of politics rather than the other, is really unfortunate. I really think that the gospel kind of gives us something fresh and unique to say. And we should be constant. You know, we should be making sure that's heard. The biggest compliment I ever had was from a journalist who read some of my stuff and said, "We don't know where to place you." Now that might be because I'm unclear or inconsistent, but I think it's because I'm trying to actually give a biblical vision which doesn't align easily with a conservative or a less conservative vision, a conservative or a socialist vision. And likewise, I think political philosophy is not the same as theology. There are different accounts of practical reasoning accounts of how political arrangements should take place. And that's a very fierce and serious debate. And Christians may validly, I think, enter into that debate and come to different accounts. And be still validly drawing on Christian sources, which is not a piece of... I'm not saying that's relativism. I'm not saying that that Christianity endorses both sides, or you can think what you like, but that actually we need to draw our philosophy out from the principles outlined from the gospel, rather than we get a complete political philosophy given to us in the New Testament or anything like that, which after all is a very short book.
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.